Our fourth case for argument this morning is RB&W Manufacturing against Buford. Mr. Bolton.
May it please the Court. My name is Stephen Bolton, and with Peter Cantwell, my co-counsel, we represent the defendant and appellant in this action, Mr. Buford. Because my time is short, Your Honors, I would like to dispense with a review of the case and simply go to some salient points that I believe should be addressed at oral argument. In taking somewhat out of sequence from our brief, in order to make sure I address this point, I'd first like to go to the issue of the statute of frauds as asserted by the plaintiff appellee in this case. In our brief before the district court and in our brief before this court, we cited case law from Ohio stating that a novation contract can be oral in the state of Ohio. I would note that in the brief submitted by the appellee, this contention was never addressed. Instead, we received a segue that since there was no writing in this case, the statute of frauds is the specter of the statute of frauds is presented. I would note that, like most specters, it is somewhat illusory because when we look at the statute involved, the actual statute of frauds for the state of Ohio, it states that no action shall be brought to charge a defendant upon a special promise to answer for the debt of another. I would point out to this court that a novation is not such an agreement. A novation is a new contract. It creates a separate agreement by the new debtor. It is not in the nature of a guarantee or a surety or other such contract. Therefore, we believe, and there's specific case law stating that novations can be oral because of that fact. They are not under the statute. So our first contention is that the statute of frauds does not even apply in this case, as we contended in our briefing, both below and here, and that therefore it is not applicable. Secondly, Your Honors, our second contention on the statute of frauds is that the obligation undertaken by Reliant in our contentions has a prepayment clause upon the note. And I would note that the affidavit of Mr. Buford in this case states that the agreement between him and Mr. Crawford of RBW was that Reliant would take up the obligation of the note. That note, as is in the record, has a prepayment clause which says that the entire obligation of under the note can be prepaid at any time.
Well, the fact that this thing is a note raised in my mind the question whether it was covered by Article 3 or Article 8 of the UCC.
That was not raised. Well, I would say, Your Honor, that it was not raised below by either party. So it's
certainly not covered in the briefs here, but the writing requirements for notes are rather more strenuous than the writing requirements for contracts in general for the purchase and sale of goods.
I understand the contention that the court is making. I would state that was never raised by the appellee below.
Just a proposition about the UCC. Now, if nobody relied on the UCC, maybe one goes nowhere here, but I don't think it's possible to have an oral note.
Well, Your Honor, I would also state that it is an oral novation to take up the terms of the note. So the question becomes in this case, what was the specific agreement that Reliant made? Reliant did not execute a note. There is no doubt about that. There's no actual written note, but Reliant did engage in a novation contract.
But I don't think that there's any serious argument that Buford is relieved of his liability unless Reliant is substituted in his place.
I agree with that.
If Reliant did not make a written note, I don't think Reliant has made an enforceable promise. Now, as I say, if the UCC would never argued in the district court, it was just never argued and the possibility has been forfeited. But it's quite striking to have the parties talking about the possibility of oral notes. I just don't think they exist in American law.
Your Honor, I would first state that you are quite right that it was not raised below. But I would also just point out our contention being that the novation contract is not in and of itself a note. It is an obligation to pay, a promise to pay.
Look, novation contract. The word should be about. Your argument is that the other side agreed to replace Buford with Reliant as a debtor.
Yes, Your Honor.
It is not conceivable that they agreed to release Buford without getting Reliant as the obligor.
I agree, Your Honor.
So the question I'm asking is there an enforceable obligation by Reliant, which did not sign anywhere? And maybe under the standard law of contracts, without the UCC additions, the answer would be yes. But I should think the UCC's obligations for a note, the answer is no. That's the only thing I'm trying to explore. And if you're right that this was never argued in the district court, then it's been forfeited. But it's, as an original matter, a very serious problem with the arguments that are being made here.
I understand, Your Honor. I understand the court's contentions, and I believe they were not raised below. Your Honor, with regard to the affidavit, which is a second contention before the district court, I would only state that the supplemental affidavit of Mr. Buford was detailed in exactly what day these conversations occurred, where they occurred, who they occurred with, and what agreements were arrived at between him and Mr. Crawford, the CEO of the plaintiff appellee, in the conference room of their corporate headquarters in Cleveland, Ohio, on July 7th, 2000. Also, this affidavit is made on his own personal knowledge.
Counsel, I read these affidavits now, and I found them very frustrating. I think I understand why the district court found them frustrating. It's because they don't describe any facts. They describe conclusions from the facts. The key clause in the second affidavit is, and I quote, Mr. Crawford stated that on behalf of RB&W, he accepted my proposal that Reliant Industries, Inc. replace me as the obligor, close quote. But it doesn't say what Buford said to Crawford and what Crawford said to Buford. It's relating Crawford's interpretation or understanding of what happened. But what the judge needs to know is what happened, who said what to whom. And that doesn't appear in the affidavit.
Your Honor, I understand the court's contention. I believe that this was a discussion between businessmen, which one businessman is trying to relate after the fact, without a court reporter, without a verbatim notes, and he is doing the best that he can to relate what the conversation between two merchants was regarding an obligation.
You're just reminding me of the wisdom of the statute of frauds and why you can't have an oral note.
Your Honor, I understand that, but I would simply contend that Mr. Buford is doing the best that he can based upon a conversation.
But if the best that he can is to give us his conclusion and not the underlying facts, maybe that's just not good enough.
I do believe, Your Honor, that his statement about the statement made to him by Mr. Crawford is a fact. And while the predicate of what...
nothing in quotations. It stated that something. It should be stated, colon, open quote, statement, close quote. And then the judge can draw the inference about whether that does or does not create a contract.
I would only note, Your Honor, you're holding businessmen to a standard of being virtual court reporters about conversations that occurred many, many months before.
Well, that's not really. You've got Buford on the hook for $800,000, and if he's going to walk out of here being relieved of that obligation, you'd think that there would be something here in writing that would substantiate that.
Well, Your Honor, I would go back to my
earlier. Businessmen are, I would think, would want to do that. Buford would want
to. I would think he'd want to do that also, Your Honor, and I would agree with you about that, that it was perhaps not the best business practice.
Well, but more than that, when RB&W sent him a letter saying, here's a memorial of what we agreed, and the letter doesn't mention Reliant is substituted for Buford as the obligor, Buford just sits there and does nothing.
Not true, Your Honor. He went back and had, as the appellee contends, he went back and said that didn't state all the terms of our agreement. They're relying on that same statement to say that, well, there was no agreement then because there obviously wasn't a meeting of the minds. And I would state to you that I believe that that becomes a fact question as to what kind of meeting of the minds occurred in that conference room in Cleveland.
What we would expect to see if this were a real substitution of obligor is there would have been an immediate letter saying, I said X, you said Y, we agreed to this, I insist that we memorialize the change of obligor. Nothing of the sort happened.
Your Honor, I would also note that this is on a summary judgment proceeding, and I believe if we go to that length, we're construing the facts against the non-movement. I would also state, Your Honor...
I would worry about that if the affidavit of the movement had any, of the non-movement had any facts in it, as opposed to conclusions.
I would also note, Your Honor, that not one corporate officer of RB&W has filed any kind of affidavit contradicting anything Mr. Buford said. That I find that absence in the case remarkable. Your Honor, as finally, as a third matter, I'd like to address the presumption argument raised by the defense. They rely heavily on a case called Davlin to rely upon the fact that since there was no note that was actually canceled and handed to Mr. Buford, there is a presumption that there was no novation. I would only note that in that Davlin case, Your Honors, there was a statement by the court that there was no evidence of any kind that the payee of the note had ever agreed to the arrangement that two of the payors had arranged, as far as one would pay one note and one would pay the other. The court said that there's no evidence in the record that the payee agreed to anything. So therefore, the presumption would hold that since there was no note canceled and transferred, that therefore there would. I see my time is up, Your Honor. I will therefore stop, unless there are any questions.
Thank you very much. Mr. Murray.
Judge Easterbrook, Chief Judge Easterbrook, Judge Flom, Judge Evans, Daniel Murray on behalf of the plaintiff, Appellee RB Manufacturing.
Let's start with the UCC. Was there any argument based on the UCC's requirement for a note in the district court?
Your Honor, there was in document number 56 in the record, pages 8 and 9, that was in Buford's memorandum. He raised a matter related to the UCC, which he never developed and the district court never addressed. I don't think it goes to the precise point Your Honor was bringing up, but it does appear in document 56 in the record, pages 8 and 9 of a Buford memorandum. I have to clarify a couple of things before I talk about the merits of the appeal. In the reply brief, Buford states that the plaintiff raises contrived issues of waiver. Every issue of waiver that we raised in the appeal brief in this court was addressed in a document number 62 in the trial court record, which is a reply memorandum, a copy of which counsel should have. I'll provide it. So there's no issue of waiver, certainly no issue of contrived waiver in this appeal. Again, document number 62 addresses every issue of waiver in the trial court that is presented in this court. As far as new arguments in the reply brief, two of the three things that counsel just raised in oral argument have never been presented to the district court, and one of them was never presented until the reply brief. The bursting bubble argument that counsel referred to in regards to the presumption was never raised in the district court, never raised in the opening brief, and raised for the very first time in the reply brief. The matter of the statute of frauds not applying in this case was never raised anywhere until 5 minutes ago this morning before this court. As a matter of fact, Buford addressed the statute of frauds argument on its merits, both in the district court and in the Court of Appeals. So to argue now for the first time in oral argument in the Seventh Circuit that the statute of frauds doesn't apply because of something other than that there is a writing or it was capable of being performed within 1 year is something new to all of us. I think it's helpful to just think for a moment or address for a moment what was the meeting.
Is there any point to this litigation? Buford says he can't pay the note. Reliant apparently can't pay the note. We seem to have an extended and expensive fight over which of two insolvent obligors on a note won't pay it. Is there some reason why this is happening?
Your Honor, we're proceeding with citation to discover assets of Mr. Buford, and we have found sources of money which were
seek attachment. He's not being entirely candid about his ability to pay.
We've found sums of money that we are seeking to recover, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think it may be worth a couple of minutes to talk about, well, what was the meeting in July of 2000? If it wasn't a meeting to establish an novation, a substitution of obligors, well, what was it? And counsel for Buford makes a point of saying that it was a meeting to memorialize an agreement. And I think it's, in context, best understood as being, and it's fairly read from the evidence that's in the case and was available to the district court, as a meeting to provide a vehicle and a means for Buford to pay his obligation. That is, he hadn't paid, and RB&W, through its principals, held a meeting in Cleveland saying, look, you haven't paid, you owe us, what can we do to get this obligation paid? And they came up with some terms and plans and ideas, continued business between his company and RB&W and the rest, but all to the end of getting Buford to pay. And, in fact, it was successful to a limited extent in that some monies were forthcoming from Buford's company, Reliant Industries, to satisfy part of the obligation. So I don't think the court has to look at it. It either was an ovation or it wasn't an ovation. I think the court can understand from the papers before it and the evidence before it really what was the purpose of the meeting, and the meeting was achieved. And in that sense, there was an agreement between the parties to induce and to encourage and to actually help Buford pay his obligation. Something that has not gotten a great deal of attention but was raised in the district court below is that in order for a substitution of obligors to occur between two corporate entities, there has to be some act by the corporation. And keeping in mind that it's Mr. Buford's obligation and burden of proof to sustain his affirmative defense, no evidence was adduced upon our filing our summary judgment motion that the corporate entities had authorized this alleged substitution.
Wasn't Buford the CEO of Reliant?
The company needs to have authorization by a board of directors, Your Honor, is my understanding of basic corporate.
Just answer my question. Was he the CEO or not?
I believe he was, Your Honor.
Okay. Then the question would be, what powers did the CEO have at this corporation? I assume you could find out by consulting the books what authority the CEO had. Has anybody looked at the minutes of their board meetings to see what authority the CEO had?
We requested documents, Your Honor. I don't know that those were acquired or reviewed. I think the answer to Your Honor's question is no.
Okay.
But I think the important aspect is the posture of the case and whose burden is it to establish the authorization and when facing a summary judgment motion. And that is Buford had the obligation to step forward with evidence showing that the corporation
I don't think that's so as a matter of corporate law. I think the rule is that corporate officers, CEOs, have such powers as are normal in the trade, unless one shows from the directors that their actual authority differs from their ostensible authority. I should think this would be the kind of power that would be within the CEO's authority. But that's just a statement as a result of corporate law. I haven't paid attention to that little subset of corporate law in some time. Maybe that's wrong.
Well, I have a couple other observations regarding the same point, Your Honor.
Which state was Reliant incorporated in?
Actually, Reliant was a DBA name, which is the next point I was going to make to the court. The real corporate body is Capital Fasteners, Inc.
Yeah, fine. Which state was it incorporated in?
Let me double check, Your Honor. I don't want to. Page 4 of our brief, it indicates that Capital Fastener, Inc. is a Michigan corporation.
Michigan corporation. All right. Well, so this would be a question of Michigan law, and I don't know whether Michigan is a Model Business Corporation Act state. Okay. I'm sorry. I don't want to waste too much of your time in this. I can look that up.
Very well, Your Honor. But the point to be made is corporations don't just act, whether by a CEO or by some other means, without some authorization. And there is no evidence in the record that Buford adduced that Capital Fastener, Inc., the real corporation, Reliant Industries, Inc., was a DBA, as appears from the record, was authorized to take on an $800,000 debt. And it seemed to me it would be incumbent upon, when facing a summary judgment motion, for the person seeking to advance his affirmative defense that a corporate body was substituted for the individual, Buford, to show by some evidence, of which there's no evidence, that the corporate body had agreed to accept this $800,000 obligation. And the flip of that, if I may, Your Honors, is that there should be some evidence as well in order for Buford to sustain his affirmative defense that RB&W, as a corporate body, agreed to that substitution. There's no evidence of that either. There's no evidence from either side of the proposed substitution that Buford is suggesting to the court that either the corporate bodies authorized that purported action. And so, in a sense, this case is much more about, I don't want to say much more, but this case is something more about the two corporate entities, which Buford says now agreed that he should be excused from the obligation than it is about Buford himself. And these points were made in the court below. The court did not address them, but they could be a basis for affirming on appeal. When looking at this case, it's not enough to say it's a oral contract or a contract action. It specifically relates to Ohio law and what Ohio requires in terms of innovation. And there are five elements which we addressed in the district court, five elements which we address in the appeal brief. Mr. Buford, in large part, did not address the elements or did not address them with sufficient evidence to support a denial of the summary judgment motion. The statute of frauds requires that a contract be in writing. This argument that we heard this morning for the first time, that the statute of frauds does not apply to a novation and instead applies to some other contract, and counsel referred to there being some case law for it. I haven't seen that case law because I've never heard the argument before today. I think a plain reading of the statute of frauds indicates that where there's, and that appears at page 20 of our brief, indicates that where a entity, or in the language of the statute, where a defendant is held or charged with answering for the debt of another person, there's no question, there can't be any question from a factual standpoint that the debt was not Reliance or Capital's, that it was Buford's.
Thank you very much, Mr. Murray.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I see my time's up.
Thank you, Mr. Bolton. The case is taken under advisement.